Hello, everybody, and welcome to the weekly Digitally Uploaded podcast. I'm Matt Sainsbury, the editor-in-chief of digitallydownloaded.net. And with me this week, we have Trent. Hello, Trent.
Hello. I'm always here these days, aren't I?
It's good. It's good to have you around. We also have a new person on the podcast this week. We have Scylla. Hello, Scylla.
Hello.
Good to have you on.
Yes, it's my first time, so I'm really excited.
Excellent. We've got plenty to talk about. It should be a good podcast. We're going to kick things off.
Bad experience yet.
No, it's going to be all good. We're good peoples, really. We really are, I think. That's what we tell people anyway. So we're going to go to some or our usual Hatsune Miku music. This week I've picked Medley from Final Fantasy. It's one of those mornings. I've picked a medley from Project Diva X, which is, it's really cool. It's a combination of a couple of hits, and it's a good way to start things off. So have a listen. I'll try and get my thoughts in order, and then we'll come and chat. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. So for the first section of our podcast this week, we're actually going to start by not talking about games at all, but something that's, I think, near and dear to anybody who likes their Japanese games anyway, Studio Ghibli. Unfortunately, one of the co-founders of Studio Ghibli passed away this week, Isao Takahata, and he's actually probably, if anything, more respected within the kind of the animation industry than even Miyazaki. His films included Grave of the Fireflies and, well, after that one, that film alone is just incredible. But he's also done Pompoko and My Neighbors, the Yamadas, and he recently got nominated for an Academy Award for Princess Kaguya, which is an amazing film as well. So he's obviously been in the industry a very long time. He passed away at 82, which is tragic and sad. And I think anybody that likes their Japanese games or animation has certainly seen and respected at least some of his films, and rest in peace and so on. But we wanted to talk about, I guess, some of our favorite Studio Ghibli films. And as I mentioned earlier, I think Grave of the Fireflies is an absolutely amazing film. It's not an easy one to watch by any means. It's quite, well, it's set during the war and tells a pretty emotional story about the impact that the war had on people in Japan. And I think everybody should watch it to get a different perspective on all of those events and the human cost that World War II brought to the world. So, yeah, not an easy film to watch by any means, and quite sad, and you probably only watch it once, but it will stay with you for a very long time afterwards. Is that a film that either of you two have seen?
Yes, actually, that's my favorite Ghibli film of all time.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, it's pretty ironic that we're talking about it the most.
Yeah, I mean, what do you like about it? It's obviously not an easy film to watch, as I said. It's pretty emotional.
I think when I bought it, I went in not really knowing what it was about. And then I was surprised by how emotionally charged it was. And it really left an impact on me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I must admit, when I watched it for the first time, I was sort of familiar with the general thrust of it, but I wasn't expecting what it was exactly. I mean, before, it was one of the first Ghibli films I watched when I was starting to catch up on them all. And I watched it pretty close to the likes of My Neighbor Totoro and Howl's Moving Castle. So yeah, it was a tonal shift, to say the least.
especially
compared to Totoro. Although, mind you, Totoro has its moments. It's not a purely cheery film, as cute as the characters
see,
are.
See, I'm more of a Miyazaki kind of guy, so Totoro would have been, you know, one of my favourites. So, ironically, I haven't actually seen some of the earlier Ghibli films like Grave of the Fireflies, Castle in the Sky. I did start to pick up things like Porcarosa is one of the more recent ones, but but again, it's a Miyazaki one, so it doesn't really help us here, does it?
Yeah, I mean, Miyazaki is certainly kind of the dominant face of Studio Ghibli for whatever reason. I think actually part of the reason was that he was more willing to be the face, and Takahata was more behind the scenes and was more committed to, just kind of creating what he wanted to create. So, and I think also, I mean, when you look at films like Princess Mononoke and even before that, Nausicaa and Totoro and so on, those earlier films, certainly the more commercial successes, especially in the West, I think came from Miyazaki. So I think that's where the West's infatuation with his films come from. But yeah, I do know that within the animation industry in particular, and within Japan, Takahata has so much respect for the kind of films that he produces. And it's interesting because he actually didn't come from an animation background at all. He couldn't draw, which I found an interesting and amusing anecdote, because you always expect anybody who's involved in animation to be quite good at animation themselves. But he was more a writer and a director, and somehow managed to end up leading projects. It was his story to where he got to in Studio Ghibli is certainly an interesting one.
Yeah, that's actually quite impressive.
It was interesting. I was just going to say that his last movie, The Tale of Princess Kaiga, that was actually one which I quite enjoyed and thought, in terms of the more recent output around that time, it was actually, you know, it stood quite high compared to them. And I was actually quite enjoyed by that particular movie compared to the rest around that era. So I guess he did leave on a bang, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the later Ghibli films before it started to wind the company back, I guess. And yeah, I'm going to admit that I actually haven't seen it yet. that's one of the few Ghibli films I haven't got around to seeing yet. It's newer, I guess, so I was still catching up on older ones even until relatively recently. I do need to watch it. I know I need to see it. I think the most recent Ghibli film I've seen is Ponyo, I want to say. Did I see another one after that? It's hard to remember the exact order they were released, but I think Ponyo was the most recent one I saw, which is a Miyazaki production. That's another great film. They're all great films. I don't think there's ever been a bad Studio Ghibli film, ever.
No, definitely.
Actually, no. Some people don't like Earthsea.
Earthsea? Yeah, Earthsea sort of the, yeah. Definitely Earthsea is the one which people sort of forget or put out of their mind.
Well, that one wasn't actually done by either of them. That was done by Miyazaki's son, actually. So that was, I guess, a tangent project compared to some of the other, or the majority of the other works.
Well, it's also done from up on Poppy Hill, and I like that one. That was actually a pretty good one. So it's...
Yeah. He did too. I mean, he's obviously talented. They wouldn't give him a film to do if he didn't have talent and he didn't know what he was doing. But, yeah, I mean, compared to the two greats, it's easy to forget some of the projects that he worked on. Gosh, there's a lot of Studio Ghibli films. Anyway, so yeah, we just wanted to talk about those and hopefully all the names that we dropped through that section gives you some ideas of some films to watch, because if you haven't seen Studio Ghibli films yet, if you haven't got too much experience with them, I certainly recommend going out and watching some of them. Use this week's tragic events, I guess, as an excuse to start catching up, because once you start watching them, you'll become a real fan. Because yeah, I mean, it, people talk about it as though it's Japan's answer to Disney, but I think that's a nonsense comparison, because Disney does its thing and Studio Ghibli has a very different tone and very different approach to filmmaking, and they're all very beautiful films. So have a watch. And on that note, we'll go to some music from a video game this time. we'll listen to some music from Final Fantasy VI and then come back and talk about games as we usually do on this podcast. So, for the second section of the podcast, we're going to talk about video games that are primarily designed for children, but games that also adults can really enjoy as well. The reason that we came up with this idea for a podcast topic was because of Detective Pikachu, which came out, 2 weeks ago now, or thereabouts, and we really loved it, and we thought it was a delightful game, and gave it a very positive score on the site, and we've been playing it pretty heavily, even in amongst all the other great JRPGs that were released over the last couple of weeks. And yeah, it's certainly a game that is designed primarily for a very young audience in mind, but it's one that has enough humor, has enough personality, has enough in it to also appeal to adults. And I think when people talk about stuff, content, whether it's films, television, games, whatever, for kids, it's really important that the game is also engaging for the adult, because in a lot of cases, the kid is going to want to watch the movie or play the game with their parents. And it's important that it's also able to engage with the parents so that they're not bored out of their brain while it's all going on. And I think quite a lot of entertainment made for kids forgets that, and the best examples of it don't. So yeah, I mean, are there any examples of games that you've played recently that you think are amazing, fun, but also primarily designed for children?
I'm playing the Adventure Pals at the moment, and I would say that's definitely a good example of a game that's colourful and aimed for children, but is also enjoyed by an older audience.
In what way do you think it kind of works for adults as well? Is it the humour? Is it the design of the game? I mean, what is it that an adult can also really latch onto it?
So I would say the design is fairly universal. It would be more the humour in the game that is adult-centric. The jokes would rather go over the children's head. For example, yesterday I was doing a quest for a group of foxes who were playing music, but they said that they lost their jive and they needed me to get a certain potion for them so they could get creative, which a child wouldn't think into too much, but I got a kick out of going and helping them out.
Yeah, and it seems to be like humor seems to be the way that a lot of the better quality kind of kids entertainment also appeals to adults. And I mean, Detective Pikachu does that as well. There's quite a bit of humor in there that is very subtle, so it would wash over a kid's head. But as an adult, you kind of think, well, that's very adult kind of humor as well, which is always good. Another good example of that would be the Pokemon series itself. I mean, everyone knows that kids love Pokemon and stuff, but the way that a lot of the Pokemon are named is very adult-centric humor in a lot of cases. And yeah, kids don't really realize it till they go back and play it a couple of decades later or a decade or so
like
later.
Joke that Muck has come backwards.
What's that?
Muck has come backwards.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, that was an inspired bit of humor, if that was intentional by the developer, and I'm sure it was. No, but I mean, I think actually Pokemon's a great example, because a lot of the character names also kind of are missed in the West, but in Japan, for instance, where they're named, the characters' name, the puns come thick and fast, it's a funnier game than I think a lot of people realize. People think it's all just cute and interesting, your monsters and weird designs and stuff. But no, the names are often really hilarious. Actually, Dragon Quest is another good example of that. I don't know if you guys have had much experience with Dragon Quest, but again, it's very bright, colorful kind of games, and perhaps aimed a little bit older than young kids, but definitely children can play those games and enjoy them. But again, the way that a lot of the characters are named is very it's humor for adults. It's very sarcastic or satirical in a way that kids probably don't notice. But Trent,
yes.
What kind of, I mean, you like Nintendo.
Yes. I could talk all day.
Yeah, so I mean, Nintendo is obviously the company that people look at for providing games for children that adults also enjoy. So what would you say Nintendo does really well that makes that kind of, that hits that balance?
Well, I think it's like similar to like a Disney approach. It's very universal in who it picks up for, you know, their target audience. So it's, you know, trying to make sure there's something for everyone when people look at their games.
I mean, do you think that Nintendo kind of ever misses the mark? I mean, I'm trying to think here about examples of where Nintendo's produced a game that adults just won't enjoy, and I'm really struggling. I mean, even the upcoming Nintendo Labo, which is very explicitly designed for younger kids, most of the excitement I'm seeing is, it seems to be coming from adults who can't wait to get their hands on it as well. So yeah, I just can't think of any examples. I'm trying.
No, not off the top of my head. I know there's ones where it's more a casual approach, such as Wii Sports and the later ones of that. Wii Music was definitely one which didn't appeal to quite a lot of people. I know that for a fact. It got quite a lot of bad reputation along when it first came out because it was quite overly simplistic. So that's one which probably didn't really appeal much. And during the Wii era, there were a few titles similar to that. So it's not like don't mix and mark, but it's sort of a different audience, I guess, which most people aren't targeted to.
Well, those kinds of games, Wii Music and Wii Sports, they tended to be, or not so much Wii Sports, Wii Play, for example, they just tended to be bad games. And I'm not saying Nintendo doesn't produce the occasional bad game.
Well, Wii Play, yeah, people enjoyed because it, despite it having a horribly bad collection of games, it had some brilliant games like the cow game. And I feel like a lot of people played it for similar games like that for the beauty of some of those. And yet it still did appeal to more older people at the time because of those select games in that collection. So let's put it this way. Most people bought it for the extra controller anyway.
Yeah, that's why I bought it.
I was going to say nobody like Wii Play, Trent. Maybe you, but nobody else. Nobody liked Wii Play. That was a 1-2 Switch moment for Nintendo, and nobody likes 1-2 Switch.
I haven't played it, so you can't look at me.
Yeah.
See, when Trent hasn't played it, you know. I think. I want to say that the Mario Party series is probably a harder series for adults to get on board with. That's not to say that there aren't adults that enjoy that series, but those games, I don't know. I just don't get the sense that those games are quite as... I mean, I can't see people, a group of adults, getting beers and playing that series much, to be honest, especially the way it's kind of gone in recent years. That would strike me as something a little bit where Nintendo's missed the mark. Or maybe it's just I don't enjoy the Mario Party series anymore.
I feel like people with Mario Party, it's sort of like they have their own, like Smash, people have their own Mario Party, the one they grew up with, the one they enjoyed, and no other version after that just tops it's like it's the pinnacle of that series, even if it isn't. And Mario Party is one of them. And there's probably, you know, uni kids or dude bros playing, you know, Mario Party 6 or something like the 64 version and saying it's the best and having a few beers. But I don't think it really captivates that market, as you said.
Yeah, I think Smash Brothers is certainly a better example of a party game that kids and adults can enjoy. Smash Brothers is amazing for that. I just don't know anybody who doesn't enjoy Smash Brothers. Doesn't really matter their age. They pick it up and they play with it. But you know why? It's because Smash Brothers has that a sense of nostalgia about it as well. So it's not just about being a good quality game and a lot of fun to play. It also really taps into the childhood of the older people who might pick it up because, you know, you get to mess around with Mr. Game & Watch and stuff. And I don't think a lot of kids would even know what a Game & Watch is anymore, tragically, except through that game. So, yeah, that's probably a good example of the way that a game could be designed so that it really it's good fun. Doesn't matter who you are and how old you are, but then it, that extra feature for the older people.
It's kind of educational in the achievements and collectible characters, isn't it? Where it's got things like Rob and, you know, Game & Watch and all the older characters. I think the newer Smash had the Duck Hunt character.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, fully playable. A long process to unlock that fella, unfortunately. But, yeah, he was amazing. He's great. I do feel conflicted about using him, though, because that game's about shooting ducks, and I don't like shooting ducks. That's a bad game. That's a bad concept. Hunting games.
Yeah, they're surprisingly popular. It upsets me.
I know. They sell really well, and there's like two or three series now that have like annual releases, and yeah, we can blame Nintendo and Duck Hunt for all of that.
See, Matt hates hunting games, but I can see the mechanic. We're sort of going off track, aren't we? But I can see the mechanic being used quite well. And say, like, I would really like Lost in Blue to reemerge and be a great series again and have hunting in it, because that's the aspect of being survival. But that said, Lost in Blue would also offer, you know, you can hunt for food and that sort of thing, like pick up like grapes or apples or something like that off the ground, or like there'd be the option to be a vegetarian if you're someone like Matt. But if you want some grueling meat and want to kill like a boar, you'd be able to get a spear and, you know, hunt the beast.
But to be honest, I'm happy with hunting in games when it's for survival and it's not the be all and end all. It's just when the game is only about hunting for fun, I'm like, nah, that's a hard pass.
Yeah, that's me too. I my opposition to hunting is as a recreation. And I'm not a big fan of games that represent that as well. I mean, I'm a meat eater. I'm not a vegetarian myself, so I don't have a problem with eating meat, obviously. And then when it has to do with survival, you got to do what you got to do. But yeah, I don't find recreational hunting to be particularly respectful of the animals, and that annoys me, and I don't like games that annoy me. So anyway, that was very off traffic. Off topic. Games for kids and adults is good and stuff. So let's go to some music, some Ni No Kuni music, since we were just talking about Ghibli a bit ago, and Ni No Kuni is obviously heavily influenced by Ghibli. And this is some music from the second Ni No Kuni, and then we'll come back and talk about, well, Final Fantasy. That's going to be a great discussion. Okay, so for the section of the podcast where we look at one game in particular, this week we're going to look at Final Fantasy VIII, and I'm going to apologize on air to Trent because he actually hasn't played it, but Scylla and I have, and we had this burning urge to talk about it. So sorry, Trent. If you have any questions about Final Fantasy VIII as we talk, feel free to chime in. But to be honest, you probably should have played it by now anyway. So
you should have. It's a crime that you haven't.
They're all berating me for not playing it.
Well, this is it's interesting because Final Fantasy VIII is kind of the forgotten one from the PlayStation 1 era, and a lot of people, it was controversial when it came out for reasons, and a lot of people don't, I guess, have fond memories of it. But I think for people who go back and play it now, it's really good. it's harder to play than some of the other Final Fantasies from the era, because this is the one that Square Enix, for whatever reason, hasn't ported onto iPad yet. And I don't know why. And you can only really play it by picking up the PS1 Classic and playing it on your PS3 or PlayStation Vita. And that's about it, isn't it? That's about the only way you can play it on a modern platform. Yeah. So boo Square Enix for not properly supporting your underrated masterpiece. But yeah, I mean, for you, Scylla, what is it about Final Fantasy VIII that really stands out as kind of the thing that you love about it?
Okay, it's my first one, so it'll always hold a spot in my heart for that. But it was also my first JRPG, and I fell in love with the story. So the relationship between Squall and Rinoa, I was just obsessed with. And then not only that, I love the mechanics of the game, and then Triple Triad as well. I spent years of my life playing that online against other people. It's definitely my favorite minigame out of a game ever.
Yeah, so for listeners who might not know what Triple Triad is, it's a little kind of card game that you collect these cards as you play through the adventure in Final Fantasy VIII, and then some people in towns and whatever will challenge you to a duel. And it's, how can I explain this in a way that's quite easy? Oh, you know what? I'm not even going to. Go and watch some YouTube of it. It's really good fun. It is definitely one of the better mini games that Square Enix has thrown into one of their Final Fantasy titles, up there with Blitzball from Final Fantasy X, I guess. That's probably the other one that really stands out.
You can play Triple Triad in Final Fantasy XIV too.
You can, yes, that's right. That's part of... Well, you can do pretty much everything in Final Fantasy XIV these days.
Yes.
But yeah, Triple Triad is definitely one of them. And it was really good because at the time, especially, it was this really in-depth minigame, and it took a long time to collect all the cards, and you could get really in-depth into the meta of it all, and the AI was good enough to be challenging. It really did feel like it was kind of a fully-fledged game within a game, and that was quite uncommon for RPGs back in those days. They tended to be very linear and very focused on just a single story. So to actually have that kind of really in-depth mini game was a nice touch. And I think it really resonated with a lot of people.
And to add to that, it's so in-depth that different regions in Final Fantasy VIII have their own regional rules and variants. So
it is, yes. So it keeps the variety quite strong as well. Yeah, everywhere you go, you have to play the game slightly differently. And there was also the risk that you'd lose your favorite cards, and that was always that was always tense, because if you lost a game of Triple Triad, and this was how you built up your own deck, if you lost a game of Triple Triad, you had to give one of your cards to the person that you lost to. And it always felt like a risk to me to put up one of my favorite cards, knowing that you could use it in the match, but if you lost, you might lose it. And yeah, I did a lot of save game restarts because of that.
Sounds just like Australian rugby, you know? You got your battle competitions, and if you lose your player, suddenly they're playing for Queensland. So, yeah.
Oh, wow, that hurts me.
So, I mean, for me, the thing I found really interesting about Final Fantasy VIII was the summons, actually. Because, I mean, we're talking about a game that was back on the PlayStation 1, so it looks primitive now, I guess. But the summons are still quite impressive in the way that they're designed. And you'd end up with an awful lot of them, and you collect them as you go through the adventure. And some were optional, and you didn't have to get them, but they were worth getting because they gave you special attacks and stuff which you could use in battle. And, I remember fighting Diablos over and over and over again to try and get him. And once I got him, I would use his summon over and over and over again because it was so visually appealing. And every attack really looked like it was kind of a world-ending Armageddon-style, you know, size attack. And the variety in them was just so amazing. And, it was actually my first 3D Final Fantasy. I hadn't played Final Fantasy VII until after I'd played Final Fantasy VIII. So for me, I got that real visual impact of this, you know, massive world and these amazing things happening when I was casting summons, which was... It was a big step from the 2D sprites of Final Fantasy VI and before.
So on the subject of summons, can you remember having to boost them? I feel like my fingers are permanently shorter from just scraping them across the two buttons.
Oh, yeah. That game had an awful lot of really weird mechanics. It had a lot of really weird mechanics. Like, I remember the other thing, and I think this is the thing that made Final Fantasy VIII quite controversial for a lot of players, is the draw system.
Yes.
And a lot of your magic that you could use in Final Fantasy VIII relied on you using these draws from your when you ran into an enemy. And I remember sitting there for like half hour just drawing as much magic as I could out of these enemies and then just healing my party. And it just made the battles very long and protracted, which was, it wasn't a great example of design, but I felt like it was interesting and different. And we certainly haven't seen anything before or after it that that's quite like it. So
I'd say that's similar to the junction system as well. A lot of people don't seem to like it, but I think it works quite well.
It's just, how can I put it? I mean, it's just a different way of thinking about, you know, combat systems in RPGs and customization in terms of the junction system and the way that you pair your characters up with various summons and stuff like that. It's just a different way of approaching job system and magic gathering and all that stuff. And I think, you know, people don't tend to like different, unfortunately. And yeah, if they were to go back, I think, and play it again, being a little bit more open-minded about it, they might realize that it's not as bad as they remember.
I feel like the issue with people not liking 8 is they played it after 7. If you played 8 first, I always feel like you'll like it better. But it doesn't have Cloud in it, so.
It doesn't have Cloud and it has Squall instead, and a lot of people don't like Squall for some reason.
But he has actually a killer gunblade. A gunblade is amazing.
I'm not the world's biggest fan of Squall, I must admit. He's trying too hard to be cool, unfortunately for him. But the rest of the cast I really like. I really like Selphie. And Irving was really cool. I even like Zach, even though he had his annoying moments. He was good in a fight. He punched stuff.
He did.
And it was just hilarious back in those days seeing, you know, Squall's out there using a gunblade and then Christus is using the chain whip and then Irving's got a gun as well and there's Zach punching stuff. It's just hardcore. It's the storytelling of Final Fantasy VIII is quite complex as well, and it takes a long time for the game to tell the story that it wants to tell because it was spread across 4 CDs back on the PlayStation. So they really did aim for epic with it. And I think for a lot of people, that very slow progressive storytelling also was something they kind of resisted. You'd still be finding kind of really major things out about these characters, you know, 30, 40 hours in, that in a modern game would probably be revealed to you pretty soon, pretty early in. And I talk a lot about Persona 5, for example, being an example of a game that's overly long. And this is a kind of in a whole nother league, because while Persona 5 is very long, the revelations come in quite quickly and the flow of the story is still quite fast, quite snappy, whereas Final Fantasy VIII is so slow to tell what it wants to tell. And I like it. I like the story that it tells, but it's certainly something that you wouldn't get away with in terms of modern story design in games.
Definitely. Are the pieces compelling, though? For example, one of the things I like about the earlier Final Fantasies, and one of my favorites is the tactics game. The introduction for that was, you know, the snowball fight, you know, that whole building up of the world, and then you're in Liverance, that sort of stuff. Like, I liked that sort of level building and story building. Is that sort of what's incorporated in 8 or not really? Or
I mean, it starts out for about the first half of the game, really. You think it's kind of this political drama where it's you're a team of rebels, or you're actually Squall's a mercenary and his team has been recruited to participate in a kind of an attempted coup of an evil, you know, overlord kind of dealio. And the first half of the game, you think that this is going to be the entire plot. And then things happen, and then the second half of the game becomes a very intense story about the characters themselves. It's compelling throughout. It's quite, I certainly every time I play it, I find myself really immersed in the story. But it meanders. It takes a very long time to get to the points that it's looking to make. So in that way, it's a little bit different to, you know, Final Fantasy Tactics Advance, which you're talking about, where everything's the gratification is quite constant, quite instant. This one, the payoffs take a lot of work to get to. But I'm still finding out new things about the game constantly. This week I saw a video for the first time of motion capture. There's a dance scene in the game, which is a really lovely scene, and it's one of my favorite scenes in all of Final Fantasy. And I never knew that it was motion captured until this week, and I was watching the motion capture work that they did, and it was really amazing. I just thought it was always animated. I always thought it was just an animated cutscene, but no, fully motion captured.
Yeah, I saw that from you and I was amazed. I assumed it was just animated as well. I didn't even realize they did motion capture back then, but yeah, the more you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it makes sense now, of course. I went and watched the cutscene again after watching that motion capture video. And yeah, it makes sense that it would have been motion captured, because as primitive as it kind of looks with the technology they used at the time, it doesn't look like something you could just create. But yeah.
Yeah, looking back at it as an adult, I agree. Like, it's so smooth and seamless. But I guess as a child, I never really thought about it, like, thinking about technology. So it's just like, yep, animated.
Yeah, of course. You just don't think about these things until you see them. But yeah, it's high time that the game got a proper remake, I guess.
I would be happy just with, like, Final Fantasy VII on the PS4 with the trophies, not the remake, just the port. Even that.
You're talking about you like just a straight port of it with
HD
graphics versions.
Yeah, I would prefer a remaster, but I will take what I can get when it comes to this game, and I would just be happy with it on PS4 in that way with trophies. Because yeah, I'm and you, a bad person.
And you just know that if Square Enix was to remake Final Fantasy VIII, they would mess with it completely.
I know, but how amazing like, would it really be to play Triple Triad online? Even though you can do it now with the Final Fantasy Portal app and Final Fantasy XIV, and I've done both to death, but playing it on Final Fantasy VIII would be amazing.
Yeah. Didn't they... I'm trying to think. They did do a mobile app which had Triple Triad in it as well.
Yeah, through the Portal app that they had.
Through the Portal, yeah. Yeah, it'd be good if they... I don't know if they could really kind of build that out into a dedicated game of its own. But I guess they could try. It'd be interesting to see if they were to turn it into a Hearthstone kind of style, full console experience thing. That would be pretty neat.
That would be the ultimate dream, but yeah, like I just don't think it would have the popularity to sustain itself. But you never know.
Yeah, and it's probably mechanically, it's probably just that edge on the simple side of things. It works within the context of a mini game, but if you're to try and build it out into a fully fledged thing, it might just be a little bit difficult to get that complexity into it, especially compared to what a lot of the other collectible card games are doing these days.
Just yeah, that's
true. Premium and make it like so you to collect the cards, you have to like send out like warriors and then they have like a time limit to when they come back. That sort of stuff. People like that sort of stuff in games.
Good. The Triple Triad on the Portal app is already freemium, and oh my god, I couldn't imagine another one.
So yeah, Final Fantasy VIII, if you haven't played it yet, like Trent, do so because you should. It is one of the classics, I guess, that's has been kind of forgotten a bit. And I would certainly recommend it over, especially Final Fantasy VII today. Final Fantasy IX is probably closer, I think, to modern standards as well. But Final Fantasy VIII is certainly a PlayStation. While it's a PlayStation game, it feels very modern still and looks like what Square Enix has been trying to do with Final Fantasy since as well. So yeah, give it a go if you get a chance. And we might finish up this week's podcast on that note with some music from Final Fantasy VIII, because it's got a good soundtrack as well.
It's the best Thanks soundtrack.
Thanks very much for being on the podcast, everybody. And we will see you next week.